Sometimes you choose courage, and at other times it's forced upon you. Courage Unraveled is a podcast series where you get to listen to insights, discussions, conversations, and stories from people from all walks of life. You'll be served with dollops of courage, resilience, and strength here. So come along and be educated and inspired. You just may find new ways to flex your own courage muscle. My name is Sana Turnock, and I'm your host. Libby Finlayson grew up rurally and on stations during her childhood and eventually got married to a farmer. She loved her life. She was on acreage, worked the land and with animals, got to ride horses all the time, and began a family with her husband. One day, it all changed. She was given unexpected news. Her husband no longer wanted to be married to her. Libby's whole world was rocked. The farming and community life she adored was no more. Find out how Libby changed her life and used deep emotional pain as fuel to help others in a way that would never have happened if she was still married. Note, in this interview, you may hear a dog barking from time to time. Allow it to be part of the rural ambience. It's a real privilege to be able to share these inspiring podcasts of courage with you. The work undertaken takes many hours to put together and is self-funded. Become a Courage Unraveled patron on Patreon, and not only will you be supporting the podcast, you will also be helping yourself by investing in your own courage. Get access to pre-release episodes and Patreon-y specials. It's easy being a patron, and the first tiers are less than 2 coffees per month. Cultivate and flex your courage muscle by signing up for a one-to-one Grow Into My Courage program and grab your very own journal. You grow your courage muscle by activating it. Listen to the podcasts, grab yourself the courage journal, sign up to the Grow Into My Courage program and become a patron. After this episode, head over to courageunraveled.com. It's all happening there. Grow into your courage today. Hello, Libby, and welcome to Courage Unraveled.
Hi, Sana. How are you today?
Great. It's really good to have you on the program today. It's about understanding Libby's life before we got to meet up in a local Southwest community. Libby, I want to start off by saying that you grew up on a station in the northwest of Western Australia and have also experienced farm life as well as living regionally. So let's start the conversation by giving us a sense of what it was like actually growing up on a station.
It's the best life. I know I can say that because I lived it, and people that haven't lived it might be going, well, how do you know that? But it's just such an amazing way for kids to grow up. There is so much freedom, yet there is so much responsibility at the same time. And there is so much opportunity to learn how to be resilient and how to take care of yourself and take care of others, especially animals. They teach you a lot. When you grow up in the middle of basically the desert and you're surrounded by arid bushland and town is not around the corner, you can't just go to the shops and get what you want. There's no instant gratification that the kids today have. You spend a lot of time on your own, even though you're surrounded by your family and staff, you still spend a lot of time on your own. It's a really good way to use your imagination, and it's a really healthy environment. You're living off the land a lot, and you're without the chemicals that modern farming has. So it's just a really, really healthy way to grow up.
When you talk about it in that way, it's really easy for people to romanticise rural and isolated living. But what's the other side? What's the flip side to that?
The flip side is, one, hospitals aren't close. So if you do get injured and injured badly, you have a higher risk of not making it than someone that lives in the city. Also, it's a hard life. It's hard work. It's dependent on the weather. You can have drought for years and years and not be making any money. So there's a lot of financial stress. You don't have the conveniences that the modern day, you know, sort of, or even back when I was growing up, that the city people had. Schooling-wise, I did School of the Air. When I first went to boarding school, I was petrified. I went to year 7 and I was this shy little thing, and I was absolutely petrified of going to boarding school. And all I wanted to do was go home and ride my horse. That's all I wanted to do, play with my dogs and kick around in the red dirt. I did not want to go because I was shy by nature, which I know you wouldn't believe now, but and I was just this country kid that didn't want to go to the city. Schooling is a big one. If you don't have a good governess or your mum's trying to teach you, of course, kids never listen to their mum. We used to run off all the time when mum went to town. We'd run away from the governess and hide, not do any schoolwork. So there's all those fabulous things, but there are also, I suppose, disadvantages in a way when we were growing up.
I am surprised that you said that you were really quiet and shy at 21, because at 21 you took yourself away for a solo adventure up to the Kimberley in the northwest of Western Australia, and then after that to North Queensland. So that takes a level of adventurous spirit and courage to do that. So why did you decide to do that?
I just wanted to get back to the land. Our parents had sold the station when I was in year 12 and had moved into Kalgoorlie. We were on a station near Leonora. So we moved to Kalgoorlie. For me, I always wanted to go back and work at home on the land when I finished school for a year or two before I decided what to do with my life, which was all I wanted to do with my life at that stage. But because I didn't have that opportunity to go home, I decided I would do it elsewhere. So I spent a couple of years in Perth, did a few courses, worked in Perth. It wasn't my thing. So I kind of made a plan for my life, and I said I wanted to travel overseas. I wanted to work up in the Kimberleys on a cattle station, and I just wanted to get out of the city. So I sort of had a plan of what I wanted to do. And so I just said, right, well, now it's time. I'm going to go and work on a cattle station in the Kimberleys. And then after the Kimberleys, it was like, well, I might as well go to Queensland. And then it was like, right, I need to save money to travel. So then I went and worked in mining so I could save money to travel overseas. It's funny that you say, because I was a really shy kid and I really struggled at school academically. I didn't know how to really perform. I didn't understand the concept of actually knuckling down and studying. I was always distracted like that. So for me, it was finding my way and being true to who I was. And I was like, I'd grown up a little bit by the time I was that age. I was like, well, who am I? Well, this is what I love and this is what I want to do. I was never scared then of going on my own. I missed so many of my friends' 21sts and all those things because I wanted to go and do that. I didn't want to be in the city and go to those hundreds of parties. I just wanted to go and be in the bush. Yeah.
It sounds like you were someone who was a practical-based learner, like you learned from experience, you know, and that's great. When you understand that about yourself, then you seek those opportunities more, don't you?
Definitely.
And that's what you did. Going back to the Kimberley and to North Queensland, were they any different to where you grew up at the station initially?
They were very different. We were on a sheep station when I grew up, and so up there with the cattle station, we did a lot more horse work, which is one of the reasons I wanted to go because I'm an avid horse lover. And it's just a very different culture. There were different sort of rules, different ways, because there were big stock camps as well. And a lot of them had a manager, and then you had 6 people in the stock camp or 10 people in the stock camp or, you know, things like that for mustering. And the mustering was long. It wasn't the same as mustering on our station, which was with sheep, where we just had the people coming in and then leaving after a month. The cattle mustering goes on for a long, long period. So it was definitely a different culture. Yep. Real top-end cowboys.
That's an interesting segue there, because you were a single young female working on these vast properties. Did you experience any challenges that required, you know, resilience, grit, courage?
I actually worked on a station that was only female workers. So there were 3 of us girls, and we did everything the guys did. When we had a big muster, we had the guys come over from a neighbouring station and help us, which was great for our social life. We thought it was fabulous having all the young cowboys come over, and we'd go over and help them. You just got in and did it. You just, whatever it is that the boys did, the girls did. And it's like that now up there too, which is fabulous. You've got to be tough. You've got to scruff that calf or whatever.
As this is a podcast based on courage and its byproduct, sounds like you really had to just get gritty. You know, you really had to just dig your heels in and just get in there and just do it.
It wasn't so bad for me because I grew up in that environment, but there were some people that would come in and they really struggled with that. They were like, oh, my God, this is just, they loved it, but they were like too scared to do a lot of things. And I look back now and there's some things I wouldn't want to do now.
For a city person who has no idea about rural station living, can you give us one example of something like that so we can get our heads around what was it like?
Scruffing a calf was one thing. So sometimes you'd have to go in and you'd actually have to get a calf. You look at them, you think they're little. They're pretty strong and they can be quite heavy. And you've got to basically get this calf down on the ground and then you earmark it and castrate it. I had a couple of goes of castrating, but I didn't really like it. I didn't want to do it. So I left that to the boss man. But back then too, it was really castrate with the knife. And so you'd be holding onto this calf, which weighed 30 kilos or whatever, 40 kilos, and I would have weighed 55 kilos. So it was, you know, it was like holding onto this thing.
Yeah.
and while it's kicking to get away, and just things like that. You'd get kicked, you'd get covered in poo. Yeah, but it was just a way of life. We were strong girls.
I've been looking at the Cattleman's Daughter, which is on Instagram, right, and a young woman who's up in the northwest and Western Australia. She's got thousands of followers, and there have been photos of her with grime and grit and just all everything. She's just covered in it at the end of a hard day's work. That's just a typical day, isn't it? You're filthy.
Yep, and you worked really long hours and the pay was terrible. Yep. You didn't care. It was one of those things. I think the pay's a lot better these days, but when I was there, you got paid $200 a week and you worked basically 6 days a week or 7 days a week from dawn till dusk. You got food and all of that, but you didn't spend any money because you didn't go anywhere. It was just a way of life. Sometimes you'd be tearing flat out on your horse through the scrub after a Mickey Bull, and you didn't know what that horse was going to go over or under or through. It was just flat sticks. You didn't know if the bull was going to turn around and try and get you. There's all that sort of stuff that you did, but at the time you just did it.
I guess from what you're describing, it's like this adrenaline that's still going on in the background. It's still the adrenaline boost or the adrenaline kicking in because you're having to ensure that the sheep or cows don't go off in a different direction, because then you've got to quickly move to maneuver them. There's constant movement, so that's what I'm getting a sense of.
Yeah.
We're going to change direction a bit now. So you got married. Where did you meet your husband?
I actually met my husband at a country western music festival in Mora. I actually did already know him through boarding school. I knew who he was. I had met him a couple of times, but it was the first time we actually kind of hung out. And then it just kind of grew from there. We have a lot of the same friends, so that was just, we all sort of hung out in a group. So it took us a while to get together. I think when I met him that weekend, I actually had a boyfriend, so, you know, that had to end before.
So you got married, and where did you and your husband end up settling?
We ended up in Williams. His family farmed there. So I suppose being a country girl, I hung out with a lot of other country people. I went to boarding school, so a lot of the girls and boys that I hung out with were from the country. So I suppose it was easy to fall into a friendship group of all country boys, him being one of them. So, yeah, I married a farmer. What do you know? A farmer married a farmer. Mm-hmm. Before I married him, though, I went to Marcus Oldham Ag College, and I went not long after we got together, and I studied for a year over there. I did agribusiness, and then when I came back, I pretty much moved onto the farm. It prepared me for the other side of the farming. I didn't know a lot about cropping, especially because I was always a livestock person and, you know, in the outback where we didn't have crops. So there was a lot for me to learn because we were crops and sheep farmers at Williams, and we had a lot of export hay and canola, barley, those sorts of things. So there was a lot for me to learn there. Yep.
What was life like in the early years of marriage? I mean, you know, obviously you're on the farm, you're learning about cropping, you're, you know, doing all that. What else?
I actually worked off the farm for a while as well. I worked in artificial insemination in sheep.
Wow.
Yeah, so I did that for a few years, and then it just got to the point where my husband was always wanting me to do more on the farm, and it was like a hassle for me to go driving all the way to Narrogin for work. So I ended up staying on the farm then and working. Oh my God, we had so much fun. We had such a great community. It was very social and it was very hard work. It was all of it mixed together. It was just a great life, great lifestyle.
When did you notice things start to change?
They changed very quickly. We had our three children and we'd been together before we separated. I think it all ended up being about 13 years, but it was not quite 8 years of marriage before it just ended. It was a pretty sudden end to our marriage. So it was a big shock. I only noticed things really changing a couple of months before my husband telling me he was unhappy. It was a real shock. It was a very quick end. It was like a death. It was like he'd been hit by a car. It was definitely something that was a very big challenge and something that I'd never experienced before, obviously, and something that took me a long time to get my head around.
What kind of processes were you going through to try and get your head around all that? There's grief, I imagine. I imagine there's anger. I imagine there's a whole range of emotions surging through your veins.
It was just full on. And you see sides of yourself that you didn't know you had, and you experience sadness that you didn't realize you could experience. And it really scared me if I'd lost a child after experiencing that. I was like, my God, if I've lost my husband, imagine what it'd be like if I lose a child. That also set me off. It was like, is this what it's like? This is awful. I think you do go through that range of emotions where sadness never leaves, but the anger sets in and you feel angry. The biggest one for me was betrayal. I felt totally betrayed that my best friend and partner in life just gave up. I can't speak for him, but in his view, he had given up for a while, but he never showed it or never told me. By the time he was ready for out, that's when I found out. I had no idea about how he was really feeling for a long time. And that's where I think now, to help others, I'm really trying to encourage and help people with communication, because it's awful what you feel. It's total betrayal and loss and sadness. Betrayal is the biggest one.
Yeah. What have you learned about yourself from this experience?
Ooh, I've learnt lots. What I've learnt is that I'm strong. I never thought I was a strong person. Although I did all those tough things and I was always a tomboy and I was strong physically, I never thought I was strong emotionally. I was always a bit more of the whatever keeps the other people happy person. I do whatever, I go with the flow, I do what other people like to do, which never bothered me. I never got upset about it. I just got joy in letting others have their way, unless it was something I felt really strong about, in which case I would then go, actually, no, I would like to do this. But I realized how strong I am, and it made me reflect on my life and find strength in myself and go, oh, I can do this on my own. I'm going to be all right. I always thought I was just a bit of a sheep, not in a bad way, but what I realized is I can take control and I can be a good mum on my own. It took me a while to get my head around that one. It's very scary when you've got three children and they're very, very young. Your whole life gets turned upside down and you actually have to leave the life that you had. It wasn't just my husband that I lost. It was my whole life. It was the farm. It was the community. It was my dreams and aspirations of moving forward in farming with my husband. It was the training horses. It was everything that I was planning on doing. It was putting my garden in open garden scheme, which was a plan of mine. All these silly little things that don't actually matter. I had to leave all of that and start all over again. And so what I really learned about myself was that I am capable. And I think that was something that I didn't really think about before.
Living remotely in your younger years, you had a level of strength that came from country, but you didn't realise it until you had this major event happen in your life. Any connection there, do you think?
Definitely. I think the resilience you build up as a kid and the time I spent on my own, even when I was working on those remote cattle stations and I was always with other people, you still spend a lot of time on your own. You know, you can be out on a horse for hours on your own. Now you've got your horse, and for me, I don't need anything else. But a lot of people really struggle with their own company. And I'm a very, very social person, and I don't want to be on my own, but I love my own time. And I think having that upbringing of growing up in a remote station and then going to boarding school where you had to learn to live with others and fit into the city life, it gave me that opportunity that I can fit in anywhere. When I went mining, I was the only girl on a drill rig with six drillers, and you know what they're like, my goodness. You hang out with people like that, and I'm the only girl in the middle of nowhere on a drill rig for 4 weeks at a time on end, working every day for 4 weeks. I think you just learn to fit into any situation. What I've realised about myself is I can fit in to any situation. I can have shooters with the biggest bogans in the pub 1 minute and be having champagne with my very rich girlfriends in Perth the next in high heels, and then be on a horse galloping along the beach with my mates down here. You know, I can fit into any situation. It just depends on who I'm hanging with.
Yeah, great. And adapting.
I'm very adaptable. Cool. That's the word.
You've spoken about isolation since moving from all that you knew and were comforted by. What have you done to try and navigate your way through those times?
I think it's really keeping connections with other people. I have a girlfriend that was living down here who was also going through a divorce, and we really seek comfort in each other. And although a lot of the time I felt really isolated, and I still sometimes do, I sort of feel like I'm sitting in my house here in Busselton in one of the most beautiful places in the world. This house and this life that I'm living isn't the life I really, really want to live. This is my building blocks to the life I'm really wanting to live. It's finding that someone that understands and gets it. I had that one person who understood it and was like, I'd ring her and be crying, going, oh, and she'd be like, I get it, it's cool. Having that one person helps you to feel less isolated. You know that someone's got your back. And my family have my back. My family's fabulous, but they're all in Perth. And family say, be strong, get up, keep going, stop your crying, come on, this is ridiculous, he's an idiot, don't worry about it. Whereas someone going through it all gets that that's not the way it is. You don't have to hate your ex or bitch about him to move on. You have to love still, but you just change the way you love. I think that's really important, and I think that's what kept me feeling less isolated.
I guess also honouring your feelings at the time as well, knowing that it is important to go through the grief and all those stages that you have through grief in order to be able to hold it and then to let it go.
Yes.
And, yes, family intentions to say, get over it, you're strong, you're this, you're that, I can understand how that can be not helpful, because they're saying cut off your emotions and just get on with it.
It's not worth it, and, you know, because they're angry themselves. It doesn't matter what the grief is. What I've learned and what I like to teach others is that you've got to take all its forms. You're allowed to feel angry. You're allowed to feel betrayed. You're allowed to feel sad. You're allowed to cry all day. You're allowed to scream and yell and punch the walls if that's what's going to make you feel better at the time, because that is all getting that grief out. It doesn't happen overnight, unfortunately. I remember ringing a girlfriend and saying, when is this ever going to end? This was like 2 years after my split. It just takes ages and you just got to go with it.
Someone who I had on Courage Unraveled earlier, they described grief is like this hole, and you will get out of the hole eventually, but there will be a hole there, and you will always have a sense of grief. It will come over you at any time. It'll be quite random, but it will be there, and sometimes you will feel it less and other times you will still feel it like it was yesterday. If you're someone from a rural community and you go through a divorce, do you think that's different to someone going through a divorce in the city?
This is only my opinion, but I definitely think it's very different. And the reasons for that is because if you go through a divorce and you live on a farm or a station, you have to change your whole life. I mean, your whole life changes in any divorce, but more of it changes if you're rural. I'm not the only person that I know that's been rural that's had a divorce, who's had to move their whole life. If you're in the city, you keep the same job. If you're the wife, you generally keep the family home with the children in it, or maybe not, but, you know, you basically, the children go to the same school, or, you know, you don't have to give up your hobbies. You generally go to the same running club or tennis club or whatever it is that you do. You still swim at the same beach with your friends every Saturday morning. You still have the same friends that you hang out with surrounding you. When you're in a rural community and you go through a divorce, especially if it's a divorce that was a one-sided divorce, it wasn't one that built up over years and years where by the time they got divorced, one person didn't want that life and they really wanted to change it. I think going through a divorce that's quite one-sided or quite fast, quite a shock divorce, you soon realise that you don't actually have a choice. I didn't have a choice in any of it. I had a choice of where I was going to move to, but it couldn't be too far away. Perth was 2 hours, here was 2.5 hours. They were basically my choices. Or I could have stayed in Williams and gone and lived in a little house in town. I just couldn't have coped with that. So for me, I gave up the community and my friends that I hung out with there. The kids had to change schools. We had to move to a completely different environment. We went from a farmhouse with lots of space to a house in what I like to call Legoland, a housing estate, which is beautiful, but it's just so different for me. And it was more of a city life. I had to give up most of my animals. I'm now paying adjustment for one horse instead of having five horses on my farm. I had to give up my garden, which was my mother-in-law, who I was very close to. She created this beautiful big garden and then I extended it and kept it going. And so the both of us just loved this garden. We sort of had grand plans for this garden. And that was all these dreams. My dream of being a farmer with my husband, I had to give that up. So I came to Busselton and I didn't know what to do. I had three little kids on my own. Daycare was expensive. I was sitting in a house and I was like, well, what am I going to do for work and what am I going to do with my youngest child? And I've got to get these kids to school. Okay, I've got to drive them, put them on a bus. Like, they're only little. If I work, who's going to look after the kids? I can't leave them home alone. I can now, but I couldn't then. So it's completely different, I think. You really do give up everything that you had with that person, not just that person.
I guess what you're saying with your example is that you believe that there's a higher level of sacrifice.
Yeah, what's a forced sacrifice? I'm not saying this to blame him or be mean to him, but he had to do what he did for his reasons. He made all these changes for himself and we all had to go along with it. But for his reasons, he had to do that. He wanted to give up farming. He wanted to give up working with his family. There was lots of things. It wasn't just me he wanted to give up. He actually wanted to change his whole life. So for the rest of us, we had to change our whole lives because of what he wanted to do. Whereas if I had left him, he probably would have stayed on the farm and a lot of things wouldn't have changed as much.
So divorce has clearly been painful for you and has made you walk through the hallway of fear.
Yep.
Yeah. It has also opened up, though, new opportunities, and one of those relates to being health conscious and the other is about the divorce itself, right? So now you are a divorce and healthy lifestyle coach. Do you have a separate client base? You've got healthy lifestyle coaching and divorce coaching, or have you amalgamated those two interests and passions and you've got one clientele? How does it work?
It's not one clientele, because if someone comes to me and they just want to get healthy, then I'll help that person. But I'm aiming now for people going through divorce. That's a kind of like, I suppose you could call it my target market, because I understand what they're going through. And I also understand how you have to look after yourself to be able to thrive through that, because that's what I had to do. And I did it on my own. At that time, I did see a counsellor, but at that time, I didn't go and seek help to be healthy mentally and emotionally. I figured it out on my own. What I realised is I had to keep eating healthily. I was very healthy anyway, but I still like a bit of naughty stuff. But I knew that I couldn't go down the drink myself silly line. I couldn't go down the I'm just going to sleep all day and feel sad line. I knew that I had to eat really well. I knew I had to try and get sleep, which when going through the darkest days was almost impossible. So insomnia was quite a big issue. I knew I had to exercise and stay fit. And that is what kept me going. I knew I had to do that for my children. Doing it for my children also meant doing it for me. What I realised when I moved is all the new people I met kept asking me, how do you do it? How come you've got so much energy? How do you look after those kids on your own? How do you go to work and then come back and you've been up since five and you've been exercising and I saw you sprinting down the street? How do you do all this? And that's when I said, why aren't I teaching people? Why aren't I coaching people? So that opened up a whole new opportunity for me. And I think I'm now going down the divorce line because I know that what I've seen since I've been in the single world is how many angry, bitter people there are from divorce, and they don't let it go. And it doesn't just ruin their life, it ruins their kids' lives. And I really want to help people thrive and change the way they love their ex-partner. They're allowed to feel angry and bitter, but they can't carry that because they're only hurting themselves and hurting their children.
Absolutely. What are you learning about people through your coaching?
Oh, what I'm learning about people is habit change is very hard and no one likes to admit their habit. We all know I had to admit mine to myself and I had to work on them. It doesn't happen overnight. People think that I'm just like this all the time. I had to work on myself and I had to work hard in my training as a coach to be able to talk in a way that's going to help others. Habit change is a really hard thing to do because you have to do it. At the end of the day, if I was coaching you, Sana, I could give you every action in the world, but if you don't follow through with those, I can't make it happen for you. So my job is to cheer you on and to encourage you and to help you thrive. Your job is to actually understand who you are and what you're doing and what's not good for you and make those changes. And in divorce and divorce coaching, a lot of that is your mental state. Find ways to let go and to grieve and to figure out how you can thrive and feel fabulous again, especially for women. A lot of women that have been divorced, especially if they've been dumped like me, is they really feel like crap. They think they're ugly. They think they're not good enough. They think no one's going to love me again. So they start going down the line of getting drunk, getting chubby. They're binge eating out of their emotional state. And so I really want to help them to thrive and feel good about themselves and let them know that it doesn't matter whose fault it is, it doesn't matter what happened, you can still thrive and have a great life and you're still going to be loved by others and you're still going to find another partner somewhere at some stage.
What you've offered there, Libby, is really insightful. Change is hard, but I guess if you really want those changes to be made, you have to do it. We all have to do it. I'm looking to change tack now and to move on to people who you have found to be courageous in your life. You've said that your mum and the women of your mum's generation are courageous. Why is that?
My mum was a city girl and she always loved the country and she had some farming country friends and that's how she actually met Dad. But she was a city girl that always wanted to be in the country, that she was drawn to the country. And so, of course, she hung out with all the country boys, met my dad who had this massive property. And, you know, he might have told her a few porcupines, I suppose, didn't realise it was so far away in the middle of the desert. When she moved to the station, she didn't have power. She had some battery power which ran the cool room and the fridges and there was a gas freezer or something and that was it. She didn't have a washing machine. There was no air conditioning. There was really none of that stuff. And she was thrown into cooking and cleaning for staff and her family. She's a fabulous cook, but when she went out there, she could hardly cook a thing. She was like, how do I do this? And it was all meat, mutton, mutton and more mutton. So it's how do I cook mutton 15 ways? She was having to think about every meal. The stores came in. She had to order food. She had to wash cloth nappies out with a scrubber. And they had a lot of pride. There was always sweeping and things to do, which now these days, like I look at it and go, well, that can wait, whereas that had to be done. But the generation before her, like my grandmother, who was on the station, they had a lot of staff helping them. They had the Aboriginal staff and they had other staff that they paid that they did all those jobs. and they delegated. They worked hard and they grew up really tough, but they had other people doing so much for them, looking after the kids. Whereas my mum's generation, they'd lost all that money and wealth then in the wool industry. So mum and dad were on their own and they had workers for the station, but no one to help mum. And I think she's very courageous that she stepped into that and didn't just go, no, I'm out of here and leave it.
You're right. And how do you think that what she's done has influenced or made an impact on your life?
I see how hard both mum and dad worked. And mum was also a nurse, so she ended up working in town as a nurse as well. Very handy having a nurse on the station. They just really had to tough it out and they were exhausted. And I think us seeing that all the time, we had to work and we had to help. And when it came to cooking, because I love to cook and I've always been a feeder. So when I moved to the farm with my husband, it wasn't an issue for me feeding the mobs because I grew up helping mum feed the mobs every day. So when I went to boarding school, I knew how to wash. I knew how to cook. I knew how to do all these sorts of things when I was 12. My kids, too busy looking at their computers and running off down the street doing gymnastics or whatever it is that they do. And then they go, mum, I really want to learn how to cook. I'm like, right, let's do it on Saturday. Oh, but I've got this party on and that party on. And it hardly happens. So, yeah, I think that's influenced me. I'm a survivor in that sense. My mum was a survivor. My grandmother was a survivor. I'm a survivor. When you're out there, you have to work hard. You're out there in the heat and the dust and you're in the sheepyards all day and you have to do it. It's got to be done.
Do you believe, it's the drum roll.
The drum roll.
Do you believe that you are courageous?
Funny question, Sana, because I had never thought of myself as courageous about anything ever in my life until you started this podcast.
There you go.
And the more we chatted at netball about this podcast, the more I thought, hang on a minute, I've got a story to tell. The courage comes from resilience. I used to think courage was someone who climbed Mount Everest or went to war, and they were definitely very courageous people. But courage comes in many forms, and I think courage is also love, and I think courage is stepping out of your comfort zone into the unknown and not being worried if you fail. It's about having a go because you don't know where you're going to end up and you don't know what you're going to end up doing. If you're going to stay stuck in your little safety net all the time, you're never going to grow as a person. I think anything bad that happens to you, like for me, like the grief of losing my husband, it's the worst thing that ever happened to me and the best thing that ever happened to me. Courage is understanding that it's not someone who's in a war. It doesn't matter how small it is, that it's just about trying, it's about putting yourself out there and it's about doing what you want to do, not hurting others in the process.
I think you're super courageous with what you've been through and the resilience that you've shown, the grit metaphorically and physically and emotionally. So keep staying courageous, Libby.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk to you.
Some people believe that everything happens for a reason. Libby is one of these people. Libby has proven to herself that she is strong and resilient, and growing up rurally and at times in isolation have partially shaped who she is today. Libby's absorbed her pain and suffering and found a way through and is now a divorce and healthy lifestyle coach. She has first-hand experience and the acumen to take women through the process of divorce and to support them to remain mentally, physically and emotionally healthy at the same time. If you want more information on Libby Finlayson, you can visit courageunraveled.com/podcasts. Visit Series 5, Episode 25. Cultivating a courage mindset is about breaking old habits, just as Libby said, and creating new and more positive ones. Connect with me if you're looking for a keynote speaker or writer for courage-related topics. The Courage Journal was created for people who want to work independently, and one-to-one courage mindset coaching is available for personal support. To learn more, visit courageunraveled.com. Do you want to join my newsletter? Sign up via the website too. If you live rurally, consider the gifts that you have. Access to open spaces, nature, and no traffic jams. You may also be blessed to be living in a caring community. That's all from me today. Libby, I'll see you on the netball courts. I'm Sana Turnock, your Courage Unraveled host.